fitted a present which paralyzed him. He felt chained to a future which, exposed too often, had locked onto him like a greedy succubus. Tight dryness clogged his throat. Had he followed the witch call of his own oracle, he wondered, until it had spilled him into a merciless present?
"Tell me what you've seen," Chani said.
"I can't."
"Why mustn't I kill her?"
"Because I ask it." He watched her accept this. She did it the way sand accepted water, absorbing and concealing. Was there obedience beneath that hot, angry surface, he wondered. And he realized then that life in the royal keep had left Chani unchanged. She'd merely stopped here for a time, inhabited a way station on a journey with her man. Nothing of the desert had been taken from her. Chani stepped away from him then, glanced at the Gola who stood waiting near the diamond circle of the practice door.
"You've been crossing blades with him?" she asked.
"And I'm better for it." Her gaze went to the circle on the floor, back to the Gola's metallic eyes.
"I don't like it," she said.
"He's not intended to do me violence," Paul said.
"You've seen that?"
"I've not seen it."
"Then how do you know?"
"Because he's more than Gola. He's Duncan Idaho."
"The Bene Tleilax made him."
"They made more than they intended." She shook her head. A corner of her Najoni scarf rubbed the collar of her robe.
"How can you change the fact that he is Gola?"
"Hate," Paul said. "Are you the tool of my undoing?" "If the substance of here and now is changed, the future is changed," the Gola said.
"That is no answer," Chani objected.
Paul raised his voice. "How will I die, Hate?" Light glinted from the artificial eyes.
"It is said, my lord, that you will die of money and power."
Chani stiffened.
"How dare he speak thus to you?"
"The Mentat is truthful," Paul said.
"Was Duncan Idaho a real friend?" she asked.
"He gave his life for me."
"It is sad," Chani whispered, "that a Gola cannot be restored to his original being."
"Would you convert me?" the Gola asked, directing his gaze to Chani.
"What does he mean?" Chani asked.
"To be converted is to be turned around," Paul said. "But there's no going back."
"Every man carries his own past with him," Hate said.
"And every Gola?" Paul asked.
"In a way, my lord."
"Then what of that past in your secret flesh?" Paul asked. Chani saw how the question disturbed the Gola. His movements quickened, hands clenched into fists. She glanced at Paul, wondering why he probed thus. Was there a way to restore this creature to the man he'd been?
"Has a Gola ever remembered his real past?" Chani asked.
"Many attempts have been made," Hate said, his gaze fixed on the floor near his feet. "No Gola has ever been restored to his former being." "But you long for this to happen," Paul said.
The blank surfaces of the Gola's eyes came up to center on Paul with a pressing intensity.
"Yes."
Voice soft, Paul said, "If there's a way..."
"This flesh,"
Hate said, touching left hand to forehead in a curious saluting movement,
"is not the flesh of my original birth. It is reborn. Only the shape is familiar. A face dancer might do as well."
"Not as well," Paul said, "and you're not a face dancer."
"That is true, my lord."
"Whence comes your shape?"
"The genetic imprint of the original cells."
"Somewhere," Paul said, "there's a plastic something which remembers the shape of Duncan Idaho. It said the ancients probed this region before the Butlerian Jihad. What's the extent of this memory, Hate? What did it learn from the original?"
The Gola shrugged.
"What if he wasn't Idaho?" Chani asked.
"He was."
"Can you be certain?" she asked.
"He is Duncan in every aspect. I cannot imagine a force strong enough to hold that shape thus without any relaxation or any deviation."
"My lord," Hate objected, "because we cannot imagine a thing, that doesn't exclude it from reality. There are things I must do as a Gola that I would not do as a man."
Keeping his attention on Chani, Paul said,
"You see?"
She nodded. Paul turned away, fighting deep sadness. He crossed to the balcony windows, drew the draperies. Lights came on in the sudden gloom. He pulled the sash of his robe tight, listened for sounds behind him. Nothing. He turned. Chani stood as though entranced, her gaze centered on the Gola. Hate, Paul saw, had retreated to some inner chamber of his being, had gone back to the Gola place.
Shawnee turned at the sound of Paul's return. She still felt the thraldom of the instant Paul had precipitated. For a brief moment, the Gola had been an intense, vital human being. For that moment, he had been someone she did not fear. Indeed, someone she liked and admired. Now she understood Paul's purpose in this probing. He had wanted her to see the man in the Gola flesh. She stared at Paul.
"That man? Was that Duncan Idaho?"
"That was Duncan Idaho. He is still there."
"Would he have allowed Irulan to go on living?" Shawnee asked.
The water didn't sink too deep, Paul thought, and he said, "If I commanded it."
"I don't understand," she said. "Shouldn't you be angry?"
"I am angry."
"You don't sound angry. You sound sorrowful."
He closed his eyes. "Yes, that too."
"You're my man," she said. "I know this, but suddenly I don't understand you."
Abruptly, Paul felt that he walked down a long cavern. His flesh moved, one foot and then another, but his thoughts went elsewhere. "I don't understand myself," he whispered. When he opened his eyes, he found that he had moved away from Chani. She spoke from somewhere behind him.
"Beloved, I'll not ask again what you've seen. I only know I'm to give you the air we want."
He nodded, then. "I've known that from the beginning." He turned, studied her. Chani seemed very far away. She drew herself up, placed a hand on her abdomen.
"I'm hungry. The medics tell me I must eat 3 or 4 times what I ate before. I'm frightened, beloved. It goes too fast."
"Too fast," he agreed. "This fetus knows the necessity for speed."
The audacious nature of Muad'Dib's actions may be seen in the fact that he knew from the beginning whither he was bound, yet not once did he step aside from that path. He put it clearly when he said, "I tell you that I come now to my time of testing, when it will be shown that I am the ultimate servant." Thus he weaves all into one, that both friend and foe may worship him. It is for this reason, and this reason only, that his apostles prayed,
"Lord, save us from the other paths which Muad'Dib covered with the waters of his life."
Those other paths may be imagined only with the deepest revulsion.
From the Yiam el-Din, Book of Judgment. The messenger was a young woman, her face, name, and family known to Chani, which was how she'd penetrated Imperial security. Chani had done no more than identify her for a security officer named Banerjee, who then arranged the meeting with Muad'Dib. Banerjee acted out of instinct and the assurance that the young woman's father had been a member of the Emperor's death commandos, the dreaded Fedakin, in the days before the Jihad. Otherwise, he might have ignored her plea that her message was intended only for the ears of Muad'Dib. She was, of course, screened and searched before the meeting in Paul's private office. Even so, Banerjee accompanied her, hand on knife, other hand on her arm. It was almost midday when they brought her into the room, an odd space, mixture of desert Fremen and family aristocrat. High-reg hangings lined 3 walls, delicate tapestries adorned with figures out of Fremen mythology. A viewscreen covered the 4th wall, a silver-gray surface behind an oval desk whose top held only one object, a Fremen sand clock built into an orrery. The orrery, a suspensor mechanism from Ix, carried both moons of Arrakis and the classic worm trine, aligned with the sun. Paul, standing beside the desk, glanced at Banerjee. The security officer was one of those who'd come up through the Fremen constabulary, winning his place on brains and proven loyalty, despite the smuggler ancestry attested by his name. He was a solid figure, almost fat. Wisps of black hair fell down over the dark, wet-appearing skin of his forehead, like the crest of an exotic bird. His eyes were blue-blue and steady in a gaze which could look upon happiness or atrocity without change of expression. Both Chani and Stilgar trusted him. Paul knew that if he told Banerjee to throttle the girl immediately, Banerjee would do it.
"Sire, here is the messenger girl," Banerjee said. "Milady Chani said she sent word to you."
"Yes." Paul nodded curtly. Oddly, the girl didn't look at him. Her attention remained on the orrery. She was dark-skinned, of medium height, her figure concealed beneath a robe whose rich wine fabric and simple cut spoke of wealth.
Her blue-black hair was held in a narrow band of material which matched the robe. The robe concealed her hands. Paul suspected that the hands were tightly clasped. It would be in character. Everything about her would be in character, including the robe, a last piece of finery saved for such a moment. Paul motioned Banerjee aside. He hesitated before obeying. Now the girl moved, one step forward. When she moved, there was grace. Still, her eyes avoided him. Paul cleared his throat. Now the girl lifted her gaze, the whiteless eyes widening with just the right shade of awe. She had an odd little face with delicate chin, a sense of reserve in the way she held her small mouth. The eyes appeared abnormally large above slanted cheeks. There was a cheerless air about her, something which said she seldom smiled. The corners of her eyes even held a faint yellow misting which could have been from dust irritation or the tracery of Samuta. Everything was in character.
"You asked to see me?" Paul said.
The moment of supreme test for this girl shape had come. Skytail had put on the shape, the mannerisms, the sex, the voice, everything his abilities could grasp and assume. But this was a female known to Muad'Dib in the siege days. She'd been a child then, but she and Muad'Dib shared common experiences. Certain areas of memory must be avoided delicately. It was the most exacting part Skytail had ever attempted.
"I am Othames Likna of Burk al-Dib."
The girl's voice came out small but firm, giving name, father, and pedigree. Paul nodded. He saw how Chani had been fooled. The timbre of voice, everything reproduced with exactitude. Had it not been for his own Bene Gesserit training in voice, and for the web of Tao in which oracular vision enfolded him, this face-dancer disguise might have galled even him. Training exposed certain discrepancies. The girl was older than her known years. Too much control tuned to the vocal cords. Set of neck and shoulders missed by a fraction the subtle hauteur of Fremen poise. But there were niceties, too. The rich robe had been patched to betray actual status, and the features were beautifully exact. They spoke a certain sympathy of this face dancer for the role being played.
"Rest in my home, daughter of Othame," Paul said in formal Fremen greeting. "You are welcome as water after a dry crossing."
The faintest of relaxations exposed the confidence this apparent acceptance had conveyed.
"I bring a message," she said.
"A man's messenger is as himself," Paul said.
Skytail breathed softly. It went well, but now came the crucial task. The Atreides must be guided onto that special path. He must lose his Fremen concubine in circumstances where no other shared the blame. The failure must belong only to the omnipotent Muad'Dib. He had to be led into an ultimate realization of his failure, and thence to acceptance of the Tlaelaxu alternative.
"I am the smoke which banishes sleep in the night," Skytail said,
employing a Fedakin code phrase.
"I bear bad tidings."
Paul fought to maintain calmness. He felt naked, his soul abandoned in a groping time concealed from every vision. Powerful oracles hid this face dancer. Only the edges of these moments were known to Paul. He knew only what he could not do. He could not slay this face dancer. That would precipitate the future which must be avoided at all cost. Somehow a way must be found to reach into the darkness and change the terrifying pattern.
"Give me your message," Paul said.
Banerjee moved to place himself where he could watch the girl's face. She seemed to notice him for the first time, and her gaze went to the knife handle beneath the security officer's hand.
"The innocent do not believe in evil," she said, looking squarely at Banerjee.
"Ah, well done," Paul thought. It was what the real Likna would have said.